Friday from teaching a month-long retreat that some of the people here in this room were at. And it was quite a happiness-producing event for me personally. It was very nice to be there. And one of my favorite things to do is to teach retreats, long retreats, contemplative retreats in silence. And a month is a long time. It's like 40 days in the desert, 30 days in Marin County. It's wonderful to be part of people's ongoing spiritual practice over a course of those 30 days, and to see the change, transformation, the challenges that come, that arise for people. Now, there was one talk given at that retreat by Carol Wilson, that many of the talks that inspired me, but there was one that she gave that kind of stayed with me for a while, and kind of thought, I should give that talk. And usually teachers only give their own talk over and over again, but you don't, give another teacher's talk. So I won't do that. But the chain of associated thinking in my mind kind of over the last few weeks has led to what I'm going to say today. And what I want to do is talk about the notion of being awake, waking up. Many of you know that in Buddhism, the word Buddha comes from the Sanskrit word bodhi, which is often usually translated as to wake up, so awakening. And the Buddha is a title, actually, it's not a given name, it's his title, because he's the one who's bodhied, who's awakened. So he's the Buddha. He's the person who's awakened, the awakened one. So the idea of being awake is very important in Buddhism. And I've read many people who said that it's common in many different spiritual traditions to emphasize some kind of awakening. And the opposite of that is that they emphasize that people generally are asleep, that the general human condition is people are somehow sleepwalkers, that something about the way in which we relate to the world, we relate to ourselves, some way in which our thoughts are captivate our attention, our focus, our concerns, is equivalent to being asleep, in that we don't see reality as it actually is. We see something different. When I was a Zen student, in the meditation hall, the Zendo, they had a rule that you could not cross across the middle of the Zendo in front of the Buddha image. So it was like here, in this room here, there's a Buddha here. So there would be a line right down in front of the Buddha to the wall there, and you weren't allowed to cross that line. No one's sitting in front of it. It's just a line right straight to the wall. Are you sitting? Okay. That's in Zen. And the Buddha was actually kind of a little bit away from the wall, quite a bit. And so then there was a walkway behind. So if you want to get from one side of the room to the other, you'd walk behind the Buddha, because it's disrespectful to walk in front of somebody, right? So you walk around. So there was this kind of line down the middle of the hall. And I knew about this rule about not crossing in front. And my sense was this line was this kind of force field. Very powerful, because you know you get a little bit closer to it and you've kind of felt nervous and you felt like they've got to be careful now, and you know, and you didn't really want to get too close because you kind of stepped over by mistake, and you know, and there was this, you know, I don't know, like, you know, I was afraid I'd get electrocuted or something. I didn't think about it this much, but that was kind of like the way I related to it. And I was always very careful to walk around, so was everyone else. Everyone participated in this rule and this idea that there was a line you didn't cross. So one day I was in the meditation hall, kind of just in the back of the hall doing something on off times, and there were some tourists who'd come to visit. And they were kind of checking out what the Zendo looks like. They didn't know anything about how to be in a Zendo. And they didn't know about this line. So I was just watching them, and they kind of were talking, and they just walked casually past that line as if they were like in the train station or something, just kind of walked right by as if without any thought about it. And at that moment, I had a little awakening where I realized there was no line there. There was no force field there. It was all in my head, you know, in our collective heads, and we had created this thing. And it didn't exist there really in nature. It was just kind of this idea that we had, and I was projecting and relating to this, you know, this idea. The force field was in my mind, not there. And that was kind of awakening for me. Oh, you know, I'm living in this mental construct, and it doesn't really exist. And so the question is, how many of us are living in mental constructs that maybe don't really exist, but are like force fields, or we have very powerful relationships to them that could be otherwise? It's just, you know, it's not in nature to be that way. So, and also when I was a Zen student, when I was at Tassajara, which is a beautiful Zen monastery deep down in Los Padres National Forest, a kind of a wilderness area, and we had this Zendo's meditation hall that there would be about maybe 40 of us there doing our Zen practice. And there was a lot of chanting in Zen. So every morning we'd have a service about 40 minutes of chanting and ritual and bowing and offer incense and many things. And there was kind of a atmosphere that creates 40 people together involved in the spiritual practice and bowing and chanting and being devotional or whatever people were thinking or feeling. And it was really lovely to be part of it for me. Other people hated it. But, you know, it was kind of this... It had a certain kind of power, a certain kind of aura, atmosphere, certain kind of sentiment, certain kind of feeling to, you know, what we were doing. And so at some point I decided I would try to see if I could shift my mental construct about what we were doing there. And I would imagine what it would be like if the 40 of us were standing at Tassajara before there were any buildings built there, you know, 150 years ago or so. And so there was no buildings, no Buddha, no Zendo, no nothing. Just these oak trees and this river and this dirt ground and the sky and the mountains around us. And we were all facing each other, because in Zen you face two groups facing each other. And we were doing all this bowing and chanting. And it would be, I would feel, when I did that imagination, I would, in a sense, separate myself from the atmosphere we had collectively created. I'd see it from a different perspective. And I felt it was very freeing. And then I go back into the atmosphere. And then every once in a while I pull myself out and see it be different. I don't know if that made sense to you, but did it make some sense? It was kind of like what I did when I was 20. I'd go to museums, and maybe this is a terrible way of judging paintings, but that's what I did. I would look at these paintings on the wall, and I'd stand there and look at them for a while, and I'd imagine that what they would look like if, instead of hanging on a museum wall, they were hanging on a tree in the forest. And then, if it still would keep my attention, then I would stay and look at it longer. But if the forest was more interesting, then I'd move on. So, if anything, I'm trying to convey the idea that we have these social constructs, perspectives, frames of reference by which we understand our experience, our life, and they're flexible, they're fluid, and we can change them, move them around. So to wake up is in part to wake up from the social construct that we have that we think is inherent in reality itself, in nature, how things actually are. And to realize they aren't that way actually. And to wake up, oh, things are different. They can be different. It's an interpretation. And what's the amazing thing that we discover, I think any kind of deep spiritual practice, is to what amazingly large degree the world that we live in is a world of social construct, the world of our mind and ideas and concepts. And very seldom do we actually see the world as it actually is, but we paint it with our concepts. And this is one of the first insights I had when I came to Tassajara, was doing the Zen practice, was how much of my reality was being painted by my concepts. I would see something and already, you know, immediately have some idea of what it was. And I'd paint it in a sense. I would see, almost anything. I would see a bell, and I would paint it with an idea of what a bell is, what it means, or the associations with it. I wouldn't see the bell in and of itself. Or there are certain things that are quite flexible. They are certain things in one context and other things in other contexts. There was a particular chair at Tassajara that wasn't always a chair. It was sometimes a stool, sometimes a stoop. Sometimes you use it to kind of stand on to get up to a higher shelf. When was it a chair? When was it a and all the associations we had with chair? When was it a stepping ladder? When was it, you know, I would paint it with different things. We do the same thing with people. And it's when I was, I don't know how old was I? I was 19. I went traveling in Morocco with a couple of friends. And I noticed when I'm traveling around Morocco, it was the first time I'd been to a non-Western country as kind of basically an adult, kind of on my own with my parents. So I was paying attention in a new way to people and reality and things. And back then in Morocco, I don't know how it is now, people still wore very much the traditional clothes. The men wore these yalabas, they were called, these kind of like these, I don't call them dresses, but these morning coats, kind of these, I don't know, these coats, these dresses, these yalabas. And the women often had their faces covered. And I noticed after being there for a while that I felt a certain kind of way of being more relaxed than I usually am, walking around streets. And I was wondering, why am I more relaxed? What's this more extra little piece of relaxation in the corner of my mind? And I realized that the reason why there was this corner of relaxation was that I had no categories by which to judge these people. In America, I could judge people, you know, all the time. You know, I knew who they were. You know, that person was, you know, back then we had all kinds of words for them. They were jocks and squares and hip and, you know, it had this, immediately put people into categories, you know, of who they were, what kind of background they had, what kind of social status, what kind of economic class they were. You kind of peg people in a sense. But back in Morocco, I didn't have any way of doing that for the people there because I didn't understand. Probably if I'd lived there long enough, I'd understand, you know, the differences and how to, but there wasn't any of it. And I was freed from that piece of kind of a painting people with my concepts and ideas. And it was kind of very nice to do that. I was very happy. Freeing, you know, certainly a better way than going around kind of always judging people. So to understand this idea of waking up, I think it helps to understand how much of our life is spent in our thoughts and our ideas. So even something as simple as a bell. So maybe all of you can see this bell here that I'm holding up. And it's a very nice bell. And I could have the desire to have this bell. I can really want this. I can cling to the desire. Really, you know, I can have all these ideas. You know, if I have this bell at home, then I can have really deep meditations. I can ring that bell at the end of the meditation, and then, I mean, then I'd really be spiritual because I have the right bell. And whatever, I have all kinds of ideas about what it means to have this bell, and I can really want it. It feels really important. And I could cling to the idea of this bell. And I could ask and wonder, you know, maybe I could buy it from the center, or maybe I'm the teacher here. Maybe they wouldn't notice if I just took it, you know. Or, you know, maybe I can replace it with another bell, or, you know. And I can get stuck, you know, get carried away with my ideas and thoughts because I'm clinging to this bell. I really want this bell. But the interesting thing about clinging is that I'm holding it up because I want you to see it, but I'm actually not clinging it physically. If I was clinging it physically, I'd go like this and really hold on tight. But the clinging is not in the physical world. The clinging belongs to the mental world right now. I'm obsessed with I'm clinging to the idea of the bell and the idea of what the bell will do for me. And if the clinging exists right now, it belongs to this inner world, the psychic world, the mental world. There's nothing physical about it. And if we don't realize that, then we might not understand where the freedom lies in relationship to this clinging of the bell. The freedom is also in the mind, in a relationship that's formed in there. The clinging is not to the bell, but the clinging is to the idea we have. And that's actually true in a lot of different situations in our life. We cling to people, we cling to possessions, we cling to all kinds of things. We say things. But more often than not, it's not the things that we're clinging to, but there's some kind of clinging in our mind towards some idea and concept that we have about it. To wake up is to see the clinging is to these ideas and concepts and not to the literal, actual thing. And that's very hard sometimes to see. So we have a spell. And I ring the bell. And it makes a sound. And this, the perception of the sound is a relatively simple affair. I think all of you probably heard it without any effort. Just the experience of hearing the bell just arose in the hearing organ. But what's interesting is not right now what the sound of the bell is, but what happens to us in, when we hear the bell. And what happens is that there's often, there might be, and it depends on your background, all kinds of associations of what that sound is like. For me, when I hear a bell, I associate it very strongly with monastic life. It means I have to do something. So I always, when I hear a bell, okay, what do I have to do now? Do I have to bow? Do I have to go to meditation? Do I have to end my meditation? What does it mean? And a good way to get a Buddhist monk to stop doing what he or she is doing, just ring a bell. And that'll get their attention. And so I hear the sound of the bell, and I think about, you know, monastic life, and that this means that I'm supposed to do something or change what I'm doing, or I'm supposed to bow. This reminds me of how wonderful it was to be at Tassajara at the monastery, and maybe if I tape record these sounds, I can bring them, you know, play them on my tape recorder, tape deck in my car, and just hear wonderful sounds, and just get in a nice mood, and be reminded to always be present. And not to rely on any external world, part of the world. And there's all these ideas, associations, what a bell means. Other people might have other associations of what a bell means. Some of you might, it's time to, you know, maybe the only bells you heard growing up were school bells. You know, it's time to go to school. And the last thing you want to do right now is to be reminded that you should go to school. And so you kind of have a little bit of aversion to hearing that bell. You don't like it because of those associations. What other associations might you have with the sound of a bell? Help me out here.
Fire.
So you immediately think, oh, maybe there's a fire somewhere.
Come
yeah.
In for dinner.
What?
Come in for dinner.
Yes.
I get a scientific thing. I get lost in the science of it.
Uh-huh. Great. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you find it pleasant? Yes?
It has an association.
Yes?
I grew up in a little town, and it just suddenly brought me back.
So all kinds of memories, all kinds of associations might arise. And then once an association is born, it sometimes gets born to a second association. Or a third. So I hear this bell, I'm reminded of Tassajara and how nice it was at Tassajara, and how nice it would be if everybody can go to Tassajara, and how nice it would be for me to go back to Tassajara, but I have all these responsibilities and a family now, and it makes it kind of hard to go to Tassajara. And why did I take on these responsibilities in this family when I could be a monk? And you know, what would it take to renounce the world again and be a monk? And I can't admit this, to people that I have these thoughts, and now I'm embarrassed, and now I'm frustrated with myself for being embarrassed, and frustrated because I have this idea that it'd be nice to go to Tassajara, and I can't do it, and now I'm angry with myself for making the choices I make in my life, and on it goes, you know, these thoughts, and it's just. That's all it was, you know, a sound of a bell. So I'm hoping you're getting a little bit of the gist of what I'm saying. And so to wake up is to realize, you know, this whole world, mental world, associated world, concept and stuff, is to see it, how it gets born in our mind. And part of the opportunity of mindfulness practice is to use the calm that you maybe get through meditation or the insight or the mindfulness to begin noticing the response inside of us to the stimulus in the world, to see how we construct this social reality, how these mental constructions come into being and paint our experience. in certain ways. And it's very hard to see that. A lot of things we don't see unless sometimes we go into very radically different environments for a while and see that things can be different. One of the things, for example, to do... Oh, there's a saying that I like. I don't know if I've heard that's a saying they say in England. And the saying is, you don't know it to each... The English say it to each other. They say, you don't know England until you've left England. Somehow leaving a situation that you've been embedded in for a long time can give you a perspective of what's going on there, and you realize, wait a minute, there's a social reality here that I bought into that maybe it doesn't have to be that way. Going on retreat is that way. It's very powerful to be together with people in silence, not be involved in social interaction, talking, and all the various things, and to let all that kind of part of our mind kind of rest. And then when it's all over, the retreat, it's to see how we reconstruct it, how our concerns about being liked by people or not liked, how our concerns about approval, or how our concerns about, you know, all kinds of ways in which when we relate to people or all kinds of things, get reborn. And from that kind of background of silence, of letting go of all those kinds of concerns, sometimes we can see all the extra ways in which we interpret ourselves and our lives, which aren't inherent in life itself, but is a social, is a mental construct, which is invisible to us otherwise. It's very helpful to find some way to step outside of the mental world that we create for ourselves so we can see how we do create it. And that's one of the things that meditation is trying to point to, is that possibility. I've told this story a lot. I apologize for repeating myself, but I think it's a good story. And it kind of points to this, what I'm trying to say here today. There's something on retreats, Vipassana retreats, that's called Vipassana romances. And I call them virtual romances, because they often have nothing to do with who that other person is. So I was in a 3-month retreat, which is enough time to get one of these going. And can you do it in a shorter retreat too? It can be done in a 1-day retreat, just 1 minute. You're not doing me a retreat. But it's called Vipassana romances because sometimes you have all the silence and concentration and stillness. The mind sometimes kind of gets carried away. And so I kind of was attracted to this woman on the retreat. And I'd never met her, never talked to her. And so I started formulating this, you know, this fantasy about who she was and what was going to be like to meet her at the end of the retreat and talk to her and take her to go for a date and then go do more with her and, you know, hang out with her and start living with her and getting married and having children and getting divorced. And it was, you know, 3 months is a long time to kind of... long enough, to, you know, to go through all those things. So I... So the retreat came to an end and we were finally going to break silence. And breaking silence involved hearing people speak for the first time. And the first time she spoke, I heard she had this really strong, I think, French accent. And at that moment, I woke up. Because at that moment, I realized that all the whole fantasy was built on the idea of her being an American. And being an American, I had some idea of what kind of person she was. But as soon as I realized she was French, you know, then I realized I didn't have a clue who she was. Even if she was American, I wouldn't have had a clue. But because she was so different than anything my fantasy was about, I kind of woke up from that. I was startled, and I realized I don't have a clue who this person was. I woke up. So I would like to ask you all, have you had this experience of waking up in this way? What would you like to, you want to tell us a little bit as a group, some examples of how you've woken up? Doesn't have to be the big awakening, just, you know. Yeah.
I had one just this past few weeks, about 3 weeks ago, I decided to test out my belief that I'm addicted to chocolate and I simply cannot have it in the house. Because whenever I do, I just gobble it all up until it's all gone. And so I bought a 1-pound box of Seize chocolates and I've been having one each day. No problem. No temptation, no craving, no... it's fine. And so now I have this, you know, well, how many other beliefs am I clinging to that simply aren't true? It was just
great.
Quite a shock.
A friend of mine many years ago had a dream. In the dream, he was holding the snake by the neck, so the poisonous, deadly poisonous snake, so it wouldn't bite him. And the problem was he wanted to let go of it. But he couldn't let go of it because then the snake would be free to kind of, you know, turn around and bite him. So he didn't know what to do. He was holding and, you know, really wanted to let go of it. And in the dream, he finally let go of it. And that moment, the snake vanished. Yes.
We used to have retreats where we would share each night, and some person would tell about themselves and the tale. But when we first went to the meeting, I remember very clearly, I would say, oh, good. Who's that person, and why are they here? And I made this huge projection on them, that I just, you know, and little things that they would do. You'd hear their story, and I invariably came out of that thing like, how come that person is as good as they are from all they've gone through? I mean, it's just total flip.
Yes.
There's a movie that I saw last night called Lead Hannah. It's an Australian movie. And that's what the movie's all about. It sort of plays the audience with all of our expectations and what happens to each of the characters based on these conceptual, I guess you'd call it stereotypes almost. Like this woman, she dies because she has this idea that the guy that picks her up is going to do something bad to her. Her car breaks down and she actually anyway, that's what the movie's about. So it's a very interesting twist. Like, it does these things.
But I have something to share.
Please.
I am puzzled, totally confused and hurt by interpretation and misjudgment of people that they imported on me. So I feel in a daily life that I have to work on myself and my misinterpretation about the world. At the same time, to screen all of the negative interpretation that people import on me and the whole, you know, environment.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't been successful to have it. I can distinguish.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's good. I think that what we have some control over in Buddhist practice, where the point is to see what's going on inside of us. So even when other people are doing terrible things to us, is there some way in which we're augmenting the problem by our own relationship to it? So it's a difficult thing to discuss briefly. But for example, the issue of what we think we need in relationship to others, and for a long time, I was very much driven by the idea of wanting people to like me and wanting approval. And I thought I didn't even know that I had this issue, so it was kind of invisible to me. But it was kind of drove me and affected me and my emotions and what I did a lot. And then at some point in my practice, I started seeing it, partly because it became too painful. And then I saw it clearly, and I saw at some point that I didn't need people's approval. And that was really helpful for me. And I still sometimes I get caught by that. But I know, kind of in my heart, that in my heart I don't really need people's approval. That's not really, you know, I don't want to offend people. I listen to feedback. That's really nice to get. But my kind of core sense of well-being is not dependent on how other people are going to see me or not see me. And that was really helpful to come to that. It reminds me of a woman. I was reminded of this woman who told me this some years ago. She told me that she was kind of in her late 60s when I heard this. And she said that she kind of woke up finally and realized that she didn't need a man. And she had grown up with the idea that she needed a man in order to take care of her in life. She was a very competent woman. She worked and took, you know, all kinds of things. She could take care of herself quite well. But it wasn't until her late 60s she actually could understand that was the case. and wasn't always looking for a man to protect her, take care of her, do something for her. And she woke up from that. Yeah, Courtney.
I have another small example too. The phone rang the other day at right about the time when the telemarketers always call. I kind of had a little bit of agitation to begin with. Answered the phone, and it was kind of a pause, and then someone sort of shuffling around and trying to get the name out, and the name sounded all distorted. And I think the average person at that point would have hung up, but I have this thing where I feel like I have to at least politely, you know, go through the motions with these people. And then after he finally said what he was saying, I realized this was for somebody I actually called for something, and it was someone who was calling to deliver some good news to me. But when they start trying to address you, you know, by Mrs. or Miss or whatever, you know, so all of a sudden I had all this agitation and assumption, and then woke up.
Yes, yes.
Not sure how this is waking up. I mean, it is waking up, but it's a little different story. But I had a daughter a while ago. I mean, I still have her, but she was homeless. And I was in a 12-step program, and a lot of the stuff that would go on there would be a lot of, like, let go, like, love and all that stuff. And I always interpreted it as, if things are going badly, She has to learn herself that that's better. And it was just an incredible awakening for me one time when I realized that I had to let go. I didn't know what was good for her. But I was still making, even though there was that let go, I was still making, making the assumption that I still had the answer. And that I had to let go of making her see it, and someday she would see it. And what I woke up to was, I had not a clue how things would turn out for her. That what was right for me was not necessarily right for her. And that was incredibly freeing, maybe waking up there. All the assumptions that I make about how I have the answers, or I know what the right way is, or there is a right way.
Mm-hmm.
Even if there is a right way. And it happened again, too, around cancer, that somehow making a decision not to have treatment about something, and then a friend of mine made a different decision to have the treatment, to insist on the treatment, but I was letting go. And for a while there, it was hard to let go of recognizing that her decision around her treatment she could be making the exact right decision for herself.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be doing the exact right thing. That's something about the and. This is my decision and right for me, and that's so that whole waking up to there's not a right way.
Great. Suzuki Roshi said, said something like, you can, I think it's simplistic, but he said something like, you can understand Buddhism in three words. And those words are, not always so. Bill?
Back in the late 60s, I was in a college in Alabama, which is a long story. But while I was in college, I performed in a play called Waiting for Godot, which is a very existential, weird, unusual play, a very difficult play. My parents were living in Washington, D.C., and I was going to school in Alabama, so I would travel back and forth between, you know, every quarter or every semester, you know, back and forth to Alabama. And I had a relative who lived, my mother's sister, who lived halfway in between in Spartanburg, South Carolina. She was married to probably the biggest redneck I have ever met. Very interesting man, mechanically incredibly genius. His philosophy was very, very bigoted. And I showed up there, and my usual, I showed up late at night, and was talking to my aunt, and she said, "Well, what have you been doing in school?" And I said, "Well, I've been working on this play. We've been in this play." said, well, what play? And I said, well, I don't know particularly if you would know anything about this play. And she said, well, what is it? And I said, well, it's Waiting for Godot. And she had not only read it, but she talked to me for several hours about it intelligently. And that's sort of the point at which I realized that every human being that you met, there was something about them that you didn't know or understand. And it led me to a place where for many years I played this game where I asked somebody new. It was to find the thing that I didn't expect about them that was interesting. I called it the interesting thing. Everybody was like, what about this person in my mind that I've already typed him? At that point I didn't know what I was doing, but I spent years playing this game, which kind of prepared me to meet people in a different way.
Very nice. Thank you. Okay, the last thing I wanted to kind of, one little piece I wanted to weave into this is that it could be, this idea of waking up from our mentally constructed world, it doesn't entail a rejection of it. And it isn't necessarily bad or wrong. Sometimes people reject one mentally constructed world or socially constructed world, only pick up another one. I mean, sometimes they you know, the one they pick up is the, if they're rebelling against it, they pick up the opposite as a way, and they think they're free, but they're really reacting to the, you know, the original one. I think the idea in the opportunity for us is not to necessarily accept or reject, but rather to use the mindfulness to help us to be in conversation with the mentally constructed world, with the socially constructed world, to see it as that, and then to think, reflect on it, and see when it's useful and when it's not useful, and to see where to be in conversation with it. And I think that's really the necessary thing. A lot of times people who practice Buddhism will reject that world entirely for some kind of idea of emptiness. But it doesn't need to be rejected at all. It just needs to be seen clearly for what it is, so that, in a sense, you're in charge of it, it's not in charge of you. So may your practice help you become freer and more awake from the world of mentally constructed projections that we have on the world we live in. So thank you all very much, and have a wonderful week.